Good afternoon and welcome to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Natural Resources Subcommittee. This day, Tuesday, May 10th, 2005. The chair is coming back from a funeral for one of her soldiers killed in Iraq, so she may or may not be here. I'm sort of pinch hitting for her today. So with that, we'd like to get started with Deb Marriott. Would you come forward? Deb, good to see you again. And anyone else you want to bring with you in particular? Very good.
Thank you.
Welcome, and for the record, state your names, please.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Deb Marriott. I'm the Executive Director of the Lower Columbia River Estuary Partnership. With me is Carolyn Lindberg, also with the partnership. And I do have 12...
And with you also should be noted is Lisa Pearson. Welcome, Lisa. All right, please get started.
Thank you, and thank you, members of the committee, for giving us the opportunity to meet with you. The materials that I'm handing out are probably more words on a page than you want to see, but it provides you with an overview. So as I go through my presentation, I'll direct you to a couple of points that will help focus your thoughts and questions. First, just as a reminder, we are part of the National Estuary Program. There are 28 of us in the country. We happen to work in the lower, what's called the Lower Columbia River and Estuary, from Bonneville Dam to the mouth of the Pacific, in both Oregon and Washington. We are now a nonprofit corporation with a board of directors. It's a very diverse board of about 21 members representing public and private interests as well as the wide geography that we serve. We really focus in three broad program areas. We have a goal of restoring 16,000 acres of habitat by 2010. We do that through actual on-the-ground restoration and then a little bit of work helping folks reduce runoff, various toxic and conventional pollutants. We have a very big program that's providing education and information to both children in the school systems and also adults through a new program we're starting with Oregon State University, or hope to. And then we also do quite a bit of monitoring, evaluating what's happening in the system, monitoring water quality for toxics, to see what's happening with the sort of bad things that we know are out there, a bunch of leftover contaminants from things we don't use anymore but that hang around in the environment for quite a while. The reason that we are here and part of the National Estuary Program is that we have documented in the Columbia River that over the last 100 years we've lost about 50% of our wetlands, and much of that has occurred since 1948. This habitat loss has pretty significant impact on fish and wildlife, and especially our threatened and endangered salmonid species. We also know from the research that was done during the Bi-State Water Quality Program that several beneficial uses have been impaired, particularly the beneficial uses for fish and shellfishing, wildlife, and water sports are not supported, as they are required to be by Oregon law. We also know there are high levels of contamination in sediments around some of the urban and industrial areas along the river. And one of the disturbing trends to me is that some of these toxics are actually increasing in the eggshell of osprey in particular, and that's not the trend we would expect to be seeing for these chemicals because, as I mentioned earlier, they're chemicals that we no longer use. And we know that at certain points of the year, water temperature and dissolved gas levels exceed those that support our fish. The things that we add that weren't there before and that wouldn't be there if we went away, frankly, is the regional framework. There are a lot of very good efforts happening at the local government level, watershed council level. What we bring is sort of an ability to knit that together so we have a more strategic approach regionally from a number of partners, and we think that delivers more impact for the investments that you make and we make in the lower river. We also because of our structure and part of the National Historic Program, we provide some organizational capacity that helps access large monies for the region. Our request in the 2005-2007 budget is for $300,000, and that's in two pieces, restoring us to the levels that Oregon had supported the estuary program and that would match the Washington funds. What your money does is work very hard. On page three, there's a multicolored pie chart. It's actually testing the limits of Excel's colors, I think. What we show you here is how we use your money to leverage additional funds. And in 2003-2005, we've actually brought you $8 back for every dollar that you've invested in the partnership. First, we get a dollar immediately from the state of Washington, and those $2 secure the federal money through the National Estuary Program. Without it, we wouldn't qualify for those National Estuary Program dollars. So that's an immediate 400% return, and then we take those $4 and work those dollars very hard by accessing other what we call competitive monies, grant monies available through foundations and other public sources. And in the last 2 years, we've brought you, as I said, $8 back for each dollar that you've given us. The pie chart shows you the distribution of where those funds have come from. A pretty significant share, if you total them up, it's somewhere around 70% come from competitive programs, largely through Bonneville Power, NOAA Fisheries, and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Watershed Initiative Program. We also have worked with American Rivers and the Army Corps of Engineers to secure a very sizable authorization for restoration pursuant to our management plan, and that goes to the Corps. Turning to page four, I thought you might like to know how we spend the money that you give us more directly. The pie chart here shows that about 52% of the dollars we've received for the 2003-2005 period have gone out the door in direct grants. Most of the money that we raise from our competitive processes go back out to local watershed groups, local governments, and other entities for them to do restoration and monitoring. We used to run a very small grants program that also funded $5,000 to $10,000 education projects, but the sources of those funds to us are no longer available. So most of the grants out, almost all of them, go to habitat restoration and monitoring. All of the money that we bring into the region stays right here in the region and supports local efforts. 2% of our money goes to supporting our fiscal operations, which is the one-and-a-half person, and now one person, who manages all our contracts, manages all this money to make sure that we not only adhere to all the grantors' requests, but also to all of the federal requirements. And I'm happy to report that all of our four corporate audits have been unqualified in their findings. What's it get for you on the ground? Well, it gets, we think, some pretty good investment in Oregon communities. As we all know, our investment in natural resources and in the environment actually support directly our economic health and the quality of life, and our monies also go to support our kids' education and their future. We've launched a water trail that runs the 146 miles from Bonneville Dam to the mouth, and that trail is also serving as an ecotourism mechanism. The website that is a companion to the trail has information on there, not only about the boating information you need if you want to go out and paddle, but also about restaurants and motels and hotels, bed and breakfasts, other entities along the way, so we can help promote the local communities as well as the river. Our children's education programs are offered at no cost, and we offset transportation costs for the kids to get out into the field. We work about 67% of the children we work with come from free or reduced lunch program schools. Our programs are all science-based, and we integrate other disciplines like photography and literature and history into the science of the river. We work with 38 school districts, and to date, we have worked with over 40,000 kids. We work with about 12,000 to 15,000 children in schools each year, and 400 teachers. We also train the teachers, so they don't always need us to be there with them providing the programs. All the curriculum that we develop and deliver meets Oregon and Washington benchmarks for grade levels, two grade levels. As far as habitat restoration, this year alone we're restoring just over 2,700 acres of habitat. The 3 years funding that we've secured through Bonneville that you saw in the pie chart will restore about 5,000 acres by 2006. All of that goes out the door to right now 19 partners, and it's supporting 14 projects. In the very back of your, or near the back of your packet, is a map that locates our 14 projects as well as the other major restoration efforts that are underway in the lower river. And I might add that before we did this map, no one had a good inventory of what activities were happening by the major players, the watershed councils, and other arms of Oregon and Washington government, so we were able to provide that information as well. And as I mentioned, we do a significant amount of water quality monitoring. Well, the big question is always, well, what would happen if we went away, and what would happen if you weren't able to support us? Financially, we would lose not only your dollars, but the ability to leverage those dollars and secure the large number that we've brought in. Lots of good work would certainly continue, whether we were here or not, but we would lose some things. I think we would lose, first, a great deal of money. We've brought in over $9 million in the last couple of years, and we've been able to do that because funders are satisfied with our financial capacity. We, have completed four audits that were unqualified, and funders are very sophisticated today about looking at the separation of duties, and in the post sort of Enron and WorldCom days, there are increasing number of financial regulations on all of us, and they look to make sure that there's adequate capacity and separation of duties. We can provide that for the region, get the monies in, and then we have the ability to get the monies back out to the local folks who are doing the work on the ground. 20,000 children each year would not have science curriculum in their schools. The water trail, which gets people out and helps support the local economy, would not be able to be sustained. We're also in the process of developing, with Oregon State University Natural Resources Institute, a web portal for the information of the lower river. I think Mr. Beiler discussed this yesterday, and Representative Morgan is quite familiar with that. And we're happy to be providing, working in partnership with them. And this is just a really cool thing because it, all this information that's out there about whichever part, whichever geography you're looking at is just not that accessible. And the Natural Resources Institute has developed websites that just make this information available to any of us, no matter how sophisticated our technical abilities are. You can go in as a student, access information. You can go in as a scientist and get all the metadata that's underneath all that stuff if you need that for your program. So we're very excited about that opportunity. And we also have integrated what we do with a number of other major efforts, including the biological opinion that NOAA Fisheries issued in 2000 for the Federal Columbia Hydro System. We've integrated our work with the work that both Oregon and Washington do with the Oregon Plan and with the Tribe Spirit of the Salmon Report. And we were designated the lead entity for the Power Planning Council's sub-basin planning. So all of those efforts now are integrated. They all share common goals and strategies, and it's a much more unified approach now for habitat restoration and education, and I hope monitoring. We hope to expand that effort, both our own and others. It's a tough one because the results take a long time to get, and the trends take a while to measure, but we're looking forward to that as well. I've included for you a long list of most of our partners, and I know yesterday you talked quite a bit about benchmarks and performance measures, so I included for you this dizzying little matrix of the indicators that we use to assess how we're doing and how the lower river is doing. We're required by EPA as a National Estuary Program to periodically report to Congress and to our region what the status of the health is, and these are the indicators we're measuring, and this fall we'll release our first State of the Estuary report. We look at habitat loss. We look at expansion of habitat opportunities. We look at changes to the riparian integrity. We look at new species and introduction of invasive species. We look at, as I said, water quality and toxics. We look at land use changes. And then we look at kids served, school districts served, volunteers out and doing work for us. I think I didn't mention that we have a very large volunteer program that's getting kids and adults out. And over the last couple of years, they've planted 7,500 trees and removed 11 acres of Himalayan blackberry, and have the scars to prove that, too, I'm sure. Those are my formal remarks. I would be happy now to let you take a minute and look at those materials and ask me any questions that you would like.
Members? President Krieger.
Do you have any examples of the education-type materials that you get out? I'd like to have some of that with to us anytime.
I do. I have more paper for you if you are interested. And one of the sheets, set of documents I have, tell you specifically what restoration projects we've funded, and a sheet tells you what the volunteer sites we've worked on, and then what education programs we offer. It lists all the different curriculum that are available. It starts with a brief description of the water trail, and as you go back towards the end, Representative Krueger, you'll see the education programs.
Paul, do we have specific, I'm trying to recall, performance measurements for the estuary project? Have it tied into OWEB? Okay. So, Deb, these are, and I appreciate you supplying us with these. They're all under development in terms of your indicators. So you would hope then, if I heard you correctly, saying here towards the end of this year in 2005, you would have your first report utilizing these indicators?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We are now in the process of collecting data for these indicators, and we'll compile that and release that this fall. There'll be a public document called a report card, and then there'll be a slightly more extensive 50-page document with a little bit more detail about each of the findings under these.
Yes, Representative Shawford.
Yeah, a couple of weeks ago, the Oregon Field Guide had the water trail on PBS, and I watched that. And is there any way you're going to be able to tell who's doing all that, or is it just hit or miss? And data. It's a great idea. I prefer a powerboat to a kayak. But
Mr. Chair, Representative Shuffler, that's a great question, and I will have to talk to the fellow who maintains that website for us to see if we're able to determine how many hits, I guess is the word, that the website is getting. And I think that would be an important thing to look at, how we can determine if, in fact, the water trail is providing the benefits and access to people that we want. So I'll talk to him about how we can actually measure that. It's a very good question. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And for the record, the chair will admit having screwed up because we need to open a formal public hearing on House Bills 5074 and 5075. Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. Members, any additional questions here of Deb and Carolyn, either one of you? All right, well, thank you very much. It's great to see you all again. Appreciate your thoughts here today. Director Beiler, anything additional that you want to share with us before we move on to public testimony? Okay. Yes, that's right. The chair wants to call Carl Schreck. Carl, you here? Welcome from the IMST. And I understand you're doing some pinch hitting today. Why don't you sit, sir, and for the record, state your name. Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Carl Schreck, and I'm the co-chair of the IMST. Nancy Molina, who's the other co-chair, is ill and regrettably can't be here today.
Very good.
To refresh your memory, the IMST was established in 1997 under statute 541.409, primarily to provide scientific guidance for issues related to the Oregon Plan for Salmon watersheds. And so our main function is to help provide some scientific quality control for information that goes into salmon recovery, habitat restoration, and so forth. And then also to try to point out information gaps that we think are critical to meeting the mission of the Oregon Plan. Basically, what we do is to review materials at the request of agencies. We review materials at the request of the governor's office and the legislature. We do this in a variety of different formats. We use small reports on a more ad hoc basis. An example would be the recent report that the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife wrote on coho recovery. So we reviewed that for them in a very short period of time. We undertake larger issues. For example, we reviewed the science that went into the situation that's happening in the Klamath Basin. This is also at the request of the governor's office. And we also undertake large projects that we think fill information needs that nobody's really called for, but that we've generated internally. These we consider are more landscape-based reports. We developed one on lowlands issues. We're developing one now on the effect of urbanization. We have another one on the table that are addressing east side issues. In addition, the IMST hosts workshops at the request of the establishing groups. We've done this for the legislature. We do it for a variety of agencies. And yesterday, you chatted with the OWEB board concerning monitoring and so forth, and we're planning a workshop concerning monitoring issues with them coming up this fall.
And Carl, if I may interject to the members, the last page of the handout you just received basically details the work plan and the activities that the IMST is involved in right now. Thank you.
Correct. I was just going to mention that Representative Morgan requested of Nancy Molina that she develop a plan relative to the budget that we've requested. And the budget that we've requested basically restores funding to the level that we had in terms of the ability to operate a few biennia ago. So what this would do would be to put all of the seven IMST members on the same footing in terms of the amount of time they can spend working on these projects. It also provides the staff that we need to undertake the activities that we have. Because of the ad hoc nature of the work that we do, it's extremely difficult for us to project accurately the particular tasks that we're called upon. We've had up to 16 different requests in 1 year that we're responsive to. And so it's very difficult for us to guess within the next year or two what is it that the agencies will bring us, what are the requests they'll ask for help in terms of reviewing documents like the COHO report, the kind of workshops they need, and so forth. So the information that you have in front of you is a rough guess, I guess is the best way to say it. It's also very difficult for us to project the exact cost of these larger reports that we write because of the staffing situation in the IMST. The IMST, as you're aware, members are appointed by the governor's office, the Speaker of the House, and the President of the Senate, and so we've operated at times with fairly large gaps in our membership, so sometimes these reports drag on longer than we would wish.
Carl, what's your length of term on the IMST?
My length of term, are you asking me in particular?
In general, for all the members.
The purpose, it was supposed to be 4 years, but starting a few years ago, it was recognized the importance of having staggered terms. In other words, that members would rotate on and off at different times, and so they vary somewhere between 2.5 to, in my case, I think I've had the longest single appointment of 4.5 years, but the ideal would be 4 years.
Okay.
With members rotating off each year and coming on each year.
Right. Great. Thank you. How do you feel that your workload has been relatively stable the last 2 to 3 years, or is it increasing now that we have, it seems, different directions coming from the administration? We have rulings in federal court about salmon recovery, these types of things, and listing issues. Is your workload increasing, or is it remaining about static, busy?
I guess I would say that it's probably remained pretty much the same in terms of the workload put on us, but in terms of the work per individual member, it's increased considerably for a variety of reasons. One is that the FTE that's gone into each of the members has gone down. Secondly, the support staff that we've had has gone down considerably. So the amount of work that's been expected to be done by each member has gone up, if that makes sense.
Sure. Members, questions? Carl? Yes, Representative Schaffler.
You know that Hinkle Creek paired watershed study they're doing? Will you all weigh in on that, or are you having anything to do with that? Or
we were asked to review that for the Department of Forestry. Yes.
We'll review it every year.
I'm sorry, Representative Schaffler. We were asked to review the study plan, not to review the progress or what's happening now. And we did that maybe 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago.
I have that upstairs. Thank you.
Members, additional questions? Representative Dingfeld.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here, and I just want to thank you for your work because you guys do donate a lot of time, the members of the MST. And I want to thank you for working with Representative Jensen and I several years back when we did the two-day workshop on the definition of recovery. And I know you put a lot of time into that. And also, I read your review of the Coastal Coho assessment, which I thought you all did an excellent job given the short turnaround time you had to review that. The question I have is, I see the amount of dollars that you have in here for your time that's covered. Do you track, or can you provide us with also a list of the amount of pro bono time that you provide? Because I know that you guys put in a lot of time that isn't compensated. And I think it would be helpful for us to know, for a typical project, how much pro bono time you're also putting in. I mean, I'd like to know for the coastal assessment how much time went into reviewing that, and then what's the ratio of the time that we're paying you versus the amount of time that's being donated.
Well, it sounds like us in the legislature.
In California.
The labor of love, right?
Chairman Kraft, Representative Dingfelder. I think that's something we can try to figure out how to do for you and see if we can provide that sort of information. I wanted to mention that actually right now two of the IMST members, in fact both chairs of the IMST members, are actually federal employees. And Ensign Molina is a federal employee, and I'm also a federal employee, even though with my function at Oregon State University, you wouldn't know that unless I told you that. So one of the reasons also for the full budget that's been requested is that when the federal employees rotate off, that there'd be money to replace them with state funding if necessary, since federal employees can't be recompensed for their services.
Yes. How effective, Carl, do you think the work of the IMST has been, and the time that you've been there? You've devoted a lot of time, a lot of energy to covering a broad number of subjects related to the Oregon Plan. What's the feeling when you discuss these things amongst yourselves, you as an organization, do you feel that you've been effective? Do you feel that the work you've done has made a difference, has been impacted, it's made a difference on the decisions that are made at the local level, certainly at the federal level? What are you thinking there?
Yeah, I think very clearly, although we always wished that you'd have a larger impact. First of all, I think we all feel very good about the reports that we've produced. I think since we're focusing primarily on science and not in any way trying to get in the ear of policy, I think that the information that's available is outstanding, and it's very difficult to really judge the impact of that information that it'll have down the road. Many of the reports that we produce are reviewed by 15, 20, even more than 20 outside scientific referees, so there's a lot of credence to the information that's there, although there still can be disagreements and so forth with opinions. But my point, for example, to the suggestions that we've had relative to the monitoring program, which we believe has helped both the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and OWEB establish the wonderful monitoring program they have, and because of that, the wonderful data that went into the COHO report. So without perhaps the urging of the IMST and the fact that we've always called for having sound data and monitoring, that sort of thing might not have been available.
Okay, very good. Members, Representative Schaffler.
Have you been asked to weigh in on or research removable spill weirs on the Columbia River?
No, we've not.
You get, I'm just curious, when you talk about all of these outside groups that look at your work, do they write you back and make comment about your work, and is that published as part of any final report and those types of things?
Being a public agency, we operate by public meeting law, so there's quite often public testimony. It's rare that we have correspondence, I would say, from user groups outside of agencies. The main target of our reports have been agencies or the legislature or the governor's office. So it's rare that people would communicate directly with us. They'd more likely communicate with you and then through you to us.
Okay. And do you have great dissent within your organization, or do you really try to reach consensus on issues there?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, Representative Cuff. The IMST basically has reached consensus, and by consensus what we mean is that we don't necessarily agree on a point, but when we produce our reports, what we try to do is get all the scientific issues out on the table. And if we get all the issues, all the disagreements out and in that report, then everybody can agree to that.
Excellent.
So we quite often have large arguments and debates internally, but if we lay those out and address them in the report, we feel like we're doing justice to
open
the scientific
and
argument.
And honest right. About the scientific.
And that's actually why we have a provision for minority reports, but that's why we haven't had minority reports, because everybody can have their say in the proper report itself.
Very good. Carl, thank you very much. I appreciate you coming here today. I think you satisfied the panel's inquisitiveness.
My pleasure. Thank
Most
you.
Most of all, mine. Thank you very much. Appreciate your good work. All right. We are going to, and I don't need to close. Do it now. We're going to go ahead and open up the opportunity for public testimony at this point. And the chair would like to call John Merich. John, are you here? There you are. Welcome, and on deck will be Jeff Overson. You'll be next, and after that will be John Moriarty. Welcome, sir. For the record, state your name and who you are.
My name is John Merwin. I manage the J. Spear Cattle Ranch in Paisley, Oregon for a little over 20 years. I'm also a member of the Upper Chewaucan Watershed Council in Paisley, Oregon on the Chewaucan River. I'd like to thank you for letting me speak to you. I think this is going to be kind of informal, but I would just like to give you a little bit of our past history and dealings with OWEB. About 20 years ago, or actually 17 years ago, I think the J. Spear Ranch was the recipient of the second, it was in GWEB grant, given for riparian enhancement. And we've been very active with different organizations for a long time, but we went along and kind of did different projects until about 1995. In 1995, we had a young man named Scott Peets, who was a U.S. Forest Service fish biologist, and he was stationed in Paisley at the Forest Service District. And he basically started the Upper Chewaucan Watershed Council. And that's when things really started kind of coming together in our riparian enhancement and watershed enhancement through the use of non-capital OWEB funds. The first thing our council did was do a very intensive watershed assessment. And this allowed us to identify the problems of our watershed and on a whole basis and individual basis and plan our attack. And it was crucial to our whole plan. Since then, we've been very active. We've attacked our watershed on a ridge-to-ridge basis. We work very closely with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, with the U.S. Forest Service, BLM, and private landowners. We, in our current watershed council, we control about 98% of the private, or all the lands in it, and we have very good cooperation amongst the agencies and the private landowners. We had in 1964, after the Christmas flood, the Chewaucan River was channelized, and by the Corps of Engineers, and that was just the thing that happened in those days. The natural meander was taken out of it, and And there was some major irrigation diversions that were rebuilt. There was not any fish passage, really, or much concern for fish passage in, although there was some. In the last 10 years, we've had 200-year events that have resulted in a very serious head cuts in the Chewakan River, and it's basically with it and the irrigation diversions, it's basically eliminated the natural passage of or migration of the red band trout. So again, with our web buddy, non-capital money, we hired an engineering firm to give us different options that we could do to have a good screened irrigation diversion and have a fish-friendly river, a passable river. And we came up with options. We went to OWEB for capital money, got a very large grant. We're right in the process of implementing and removing structures, building fish passages, fish ladders, and it's turning out to be very successful. We'll have a world-class fish stream probably within 3 years. We kind of approached it where we attacked our uplands and improved our habitat up there so the fish had some place to go, and now we're working where we can get those fish up there. We've worked with all the agencies. A lot of the OWEB money that we got is actually, I don't know how to say this, but we've used it on our private land, and when some of the public agencies saw what we were doing, they kind of copied us, and like the U.S. Fish, or the Forest Service and the BLM, and there's that whole watershed's being attacked down there. It's a very, very good project, and we are very thankful for OWEB funding.
Now, John, being attacked, you mean a good thing in terms
we're,
of...
We're improving.
Okay.
We're improving.
Let's clarify that.
Yeah. It, you know, it is amazing. People look at a lot of these watersheds, and they think, boy, that's going to be forever improving, and there's a lot of improvement that can be done in a relatively short term or short time on a lot of these rivers. We've had 80% recovery on some of our streams in a 3-year period. Now that other 20% will probably take 100 years, but it comes a lot quicker than people think, and I it's very satisfying to see that.
John, is there a hatchery up in the river?
No.
Okay,
no.
So these are natural
native
stocks,
native
fish that are coming.
The Oregon Fish and Wildlife planted that river with, rainbow trout for years, and then they quit planting it about 4 years ago. It was kind of a political issue, but I tell you the truth, I don't think they'll plant it again. I don't think it'll come back, and I don't think it will be necessary with the natural migration of the spawning trout from down below. Another thing that this has done for us, it's helped the economy with our diversion. It'll give us a diversion that has basically no structure in the river, and it'll be screened. It'll give us an irrigation diversion that should last over 100 years. So irrigation is crucial to the economy of that community down there. So it's been and we've involved the whole local people. It's a win-win project all the way around.
Have you had any real opposition from any of the landowners along the river? Have they generally been cooperative?
They've been terrific.
Yeah.
You know, it takes a long time, and that's kind of with the Watershed Council, that probably one of the biggest problems that you have is with private landowners and public agencies and public money is building a trust to where you feel comfortable accepting that money and the restrictions that are actually put upon you as a private landowner. We have found, our ranch has, or when I manage it, actually the restrictions that are put on us with public money are less restrictive than if we did it ourselves, or than what we would impose on ourselves. So, but it's building that trust between even the Forest Service, the BLM, and the private individuals.
Yes, Representative Trump.
I'm digressing. Well, how is the water situation in your neighborhood?
It's snowing there right now.
Oh, but, yeah.
Or this morning.
But
we've had it was real dry. We had but we've had terrific rains here in the last 3 weeks, and I think the river is going to be lower than normal later this summer, but it's not nearly as severe as what we were expecting. So,
but
it's looking good.
Yes, Senator.
Just a couple quick questions, because I've heard about living in Medford. I've heard about this project sort of secondhand, anecdotally. And first, I want to share with you the good news about the weather too. I'm hard to believe by living in Oregon, I'm hoping for more rain and snow. We had snow Sunday night at 3,500 feet in the Siskiyous, which we're glad to see. This late in the year, it's really a blessing of what we've gone through. What I heard was that initially there was some real distrust by landowners about this project. There was some real distrust about not stocking, but that ultimately with improvement in water and with cooperation, that the red bands, which are actually obviously have been evolved for the water conditions there, that we've had a rebound of those trout more than we expected, and it's done well. And the landowners now are really on board for this. Was there much riparian work done along this with fencing or anything else that happened? Was that part of this project, or was that just not a major part of what was done here?
No, you're correct on that. There was a we basically identified about three major problems in our watershed, and one of them was suppression of natural wildfire. One of them was cattle grazing management practices, and another one was past logging practices and roads. And we attacked those, and actually, every rancher has a very intensified grazing management plan. We're working cooperatively and have been for years with the Forest Service and the BLM on prescribed burning. And then as far as the logging and the roads go, as they're working on water bars, and that's probably where we're dragging our feet more than anywhere is on the road end of it. But no, we have actually, when the U.S. Fish and Wildlife saw the work that we were doing, when they were thinking of listing the red band, they actually decided that we were trending so positively that it was not necessary to list the red band.
Let's go ahead. I got a couple of follow-ups. Right. Go ahead.
Does every cattle rancher in the watershed have a plan?
Yes. Now let me explain this a little bit to you.
And how many are there that we're talking
there,
about?
There is five major cattle ranchers in Upper Chewakan. We are expanding our watershed now. We're approximately 130,000 acres. We're expanding it downriver to about, we'll include more ranchers. And in fact, we'll probably be close to 500,000 acres. Our watershed will be by the time we're done. But yes, every rancher has a plan or has fenced, or and fencing's not the pole solution.
Yes.
And then on the road part of the logging operations, do you see any progress, or is it just stuck?
We're kind of stuck.
Yeah. Okay.
We need to get in a water bar and culvert a bunch.
Are you? You see that becoming unstuck?
Yes.
People working together.
Yes.
Concentrating on it.
Yes.
Okay. I want to just make a comment, Mr. Chair. I really think folks like your ranchers, when people up in Portland think of grazing, they see denuded riparian areas and cows going in the creek. And I think what the message that's not heard up to where I live loud enough is there are ranchers, and we're talking about pretty substantial ranchers here, that are conscientiously out there doing what's right and putting their own money and time and effort into it as well. And I hope you do are as successful with the logging road projects as you have been creating plans and following up with the cattle grazing. So it's a little editorial, but I really want to thank you and commend you for that.
Well, I appreciate that. And I want to say one thing, that ranchers want fish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that fish are valuable. They're a valuable commodity. And cattle grazing can be compatible with strong riparian areas if it's properly managed. But you late fall grazing in riparian areas, it used to be that's what the BLM and the Forest Service said that late grazing was fine and spring grazing was very detrimental. Now it's turned around exactly 180 degrees, but anything has to be managed and managed properly. But it can be.
Senator Bates, back to you. My apologies.
Thanks. Okay. I just want to get a little more information. One of the things we ask here in committee over and over again is what actually happens at the ground level for programs like OWEB or whatever program we're looking at. It's really hard to get that information, so you're kind of an unusual case for me. I can ask you some specific questions. I've spent years putting up fences, and I've spent years putting in culverts, so I kind of know what it takes and what the cost is, and then maintaining those and putting up a fence and watching the elk walk through the next day. So I kind of what you're talking about here. It happened more times than I want to admit. I thought we should have open seasons at times. But knowing that, what actual help have you had from the state agencies? I mean, actual financial help. Did you get help financially putting in fences, putting in culverts? Was it mainly just planning and you had to do the work and put the money up yourselves, or was it a mixture of both? Kind of give me a flavor of what the money we put into these programs really did for you on the ground.
Oh, you with OWEB or with or
any agency that helped you in this project,
well,
OWEB or any others that helped you?
Well, I could be real specific. We've received several grants from OWEB and worked with Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife on juniper control, where we'll go through and actually have money. We'll hire trees to be cut or hire people to cut trees and come through with a follow-up with the prescribed burn. On OWEB, the money we're receiving from them right now, we're building 13 very substantial stabilization structures in the Chewakan River to allow for passage. We're put in 4,400 feet of 42-inch double pipeline to offset so we can move our point of diversion to a place where we don't have to have a structure in the river. I've kind of lost for words for what more to say.
I'm not trying to put you on the spot. Yeah. I just want to get kind of a feel like. And we never know for sure if it's just all going to administration and planning or it really hits the ground and helps you. It sounds to me like it really hits the ground and does help you.
Our OWEB money goes on the ground. And I'll tell you, the fiscal responsibility that we have to have when dealing with OWEB money is a very high degree. The money's there, but we have to be very accountable for it. I'm project manager of the project we're on now, of this project. And we did decide to administer it ourselves because we felt that some of the agencies, like I won't mention names, but they charged a 10% administration fee, and we felt we could do it for quite a bit less, and we are. But we're earning our money. We are very careful. OWEB's very good to work with.
I'm not questioning whether you're earning your money. I want to make sure that the money we give the programs gets to you so you can use it. That's my question, really.
And it does. And OWEB money probably gets put for the capital money on the ground better than any money we've dealt with.
Well, there's one last question.
Yes.
It's kind of a personal one. As an avid fly fisherman, I need your personal address. We can talk about
you know,
long about October.
We use the
state of potential conflict of interest, Senator.
But the rats that I'm
rod, the usual charge is $100 a rod a day usually for these things. But I understand that.
We issue over 300 passes for free a year on our private land for fishing, so I'm quite sure I could find you a pass.
I dare not come now, trust me.
But he'll give you a card later.
I'm not kidding. I want to go back.
President Krieger.
I spent 4 deer seasons chasing spotlighters at Government Harvey Pass.
Oh, you did?
Yes. Met some neat people. I'd like to see it, because this was back in the mid-70s. And there had been a lot of forestry operations. There had been a lot of cattle on the ground. I'd like to see what it looks like now compared to what it did then. I think I'd probably see a difference.
Sounds like a field trip.
I would be more than happy if anybody called me to give you a tour of our projects. I'm very proud of it.
I do that.
Outstanding. Well, members, John, thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony and the great pictures here of your project. We do appreciate that.
Thank you.
Well, Director Beiler, you can't get a much better endorsement than that.
Yes,
we'll see if that holds up to the rest of the day. All right. Jeff Overson, why don't you come forward if you would, please. And on deck is John Moriarty. Welcome, Jeff, and for the record, state your name, please.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Jeff Olveson. I'm the executive director of the Grand Ronde Model Watershed Program. It's the designated OWEB Watershed Council and Union in Ohio counties, and we serve both the Grand Ronde and the Omaha sub-basins. For those of you that might have doubts as to whether watershed restoration in general and OWEB and watershed councils bring people together or change people's relationships, for 19 years I ran a family cattle ranch in Willow County in Oregon. Used to truck bulls down to Klamath Falls every February, and everybody wanted to sell them to the J. Spear Ranch because they always paid more for bulls than everybody else down there. And it's so nice to see him in a different context. I appreciate sincerely the opportunity to talk to the subcommittee about the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, watershed councils, and the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds. But first, I would like to address an observation that Wallace Stegner made in his writings, The Sound of Mountain Water, where he said, "Angry as one may be at what heedless men have done and still do to a noble habitat, one cannot be pessimistic about the West. This is still the native home of hope. When it fully learns that cooperation and not rugged individualism is the quality that most characterizes and preserves it, then it will have achieved itself and outlived its origins. Then it has a chance to create a society to match its scenery." And as much as I think I want to agree with Mr. Stegner, I am not quite so quick to cast aspersions at rugged individualism. I see it living and doing great things on many scales. Oregon has developed its own brand of individualism, the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds, more simply, the Oregon Plan. And I do agree that there's a chance for our society to match our scenery. And the Oregon Plan, I believe, is that chance. The Oregon Plan is smart, sensible, inspired, and affordable. But it is not as widely recognized, nor is it as understood as it needs to be. It is the insufficient outreach surrounding the plan that holds it back. If you were to Google the Oregon Plan, you would eventually find, quote, "Salmon and the rivers that are their home are fundamental and treasured elements of Oregon's diverse landscapes. The Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds is Oregon's cooperative effort to restore salmon runs, improve water quality, and achieve healthy watersheds and strong communities throughout the state." While these statements describe appropriately some appreciation for what Oregon is to many people, and while the statement conveys some broad-scale objectives, the true essence of the Oregon Plan, I think, lies in the next statement, that such an effort cannot succeed through laws and government actions alone. And so the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds relies on Oregonians' characteristic spirit of volunteerism and stewardship. To say that the Oregon Plan also relies on Oregonians' characteristic spirit of volunteerism and stewardship is quite an understatement in my estimation. The Oregon Plan will live or die with volunteerism and citizen-based stewardship. Put aside the technical components of the plan and see that the implementation relies on the citizens of Oregon, with support and guidance from Oregon's natural resource agencies, and certainly not the other way around. Agencies acting from a leadership position tend to struggle in their interactions with lay people, too often encumbered with their own specific mission to see if anyone is following. The indictment is not of those agencies. The indictment is of the process through which Oregonians are empowered or not to make a difference. It does not say in Oregon's Constitution that you must be an elected official or an employee of the state to care about the health of your watershed or your community. Impressive numbers of Oregonians have shown that they care and want to be involved and that they are willing to serve voluntarily. The hub around which watershed volunteerism revolves is the Watershed Council, a community-based, uniquely local organization that facilitates the cooperation of diversely interested Oregonians from all walks of life. At a watershed council, the leaders and followers are often the same people working in an agency-supported mission to achieve mutual objectives. Watershed councils are the key place in Oregon where the rugged individualism that Stegner questioned evolves into the cooperation that he advocated. Watershed councils are where you don't have to give up your personal ideals to achieve common objectives. It would be an impossible task to put a dollar value on the volunteer work that has gone into Oregon's watershed councils. though you can be sure of the decline that would take place if councils were to disappear because they have burned out one more underpaid, overworked coordinator, or if they were unable to financially support assessment, monitoring, and outreach. You can be sure there would be no evidence that work opportunities remain without assessment and inventory. You can be certain that without monitoring, outreach, and education that are supported with OWEB's non-capital funding, the Oregon plan will fade away into further obscurity. I'm here to tell you that in our part of the state and throughout the state, Oregonians are not about to say good enough and walk away from the Oregon plan. They are not willing to leave the task to state agencies with regulatory authority. Support of the Oregon plan philosophy means supporting the Oregonians who work for free to help make Oregon a better place. Let that philosophy die and then deal with the next wave of activism, or keep it alive and take advantage of the growing network that harnesses the energy of Oregonians to do good things. You can tell that I believe in watership councils. I see some I would operate differently, others that I would emulate, but I recognize the beauty of each is that they are locally organized and operated. The technical components of the Oregon plan cannot be realized without the appropriate representation of all the natural resource sciences providing input. And watershed councils cannot hope to successfully play a role in implementation of the Oregon plan without diverse representation of all societal and economic interests. Oregonians are entitled to a return on the investment that they've made, and they've been getting it. But continued support of watershed councils and the mothership, OWEB, should be based on their collective ability to demonstrate that the work is getting done, that the expectation for improvement in watershed health is being met. Watershed restoration is a relatively immature science that will be witness to continued innovation, some of which will be successful and some of which will not be as effective as we'd like. Those successes and failures highlight the need for more assessment, more monitoring, and outreach. The Oregon plan is a good plan, and it needs your support. It needs your support through continued and improved funding for OWEB and watershed councils. It needs your support through an enhanced public outreach effort that will inform more Oregonians about their opportunity to be a part of the Oregon plan. A month or so ago, I was giving a presentation to probably 30 students and half a dozen professors at Eastern Oregon University. And to start, I wanted to gauge their understanding. And so I started with the question, how many of you are familiar with the Endangered Species Act? And unanimously, they were. So I asked, how many of you are familiar with the Clean Water Act? And probably 70-75% of them nodded affirmatively. And so I said, how many of you are familiar with the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds? And three people raised their hands out of 35 or 36 people. I have to admit that I was not surprised, but I continue to be disappointed that Oregon and many Oregonians have a dream of self-determination that is underplayed, understated, and underfunded. Excellent work is being done, but the message is slow to spread. If we really want our society to match our scenery, and I believe that we do, the capacity of OWEB and watershed councils must be enhanced. Please give Oregonians a realistic chance to make Oregon a better place for all of us.
Jeff, thank you very much. I appreciate your heartfelt comments. Are you still raising cattle?
Oh, yeah, not near as many.
Well, that's okay. I know how that is. I still farm, but not very much compared to what I used to. Members, questions? Great testimony. Jeff, thank you very much. I do appreciate that. John Moriarty, and on deck will be Mike Burton. Welcome, John. For the record, state your name, please.
Thank you. My name is John Moriarty, and I'm the statewide coordinator for the Network of Oregon Watershed Councils. However, my position notwithstanding, I'm here to speak to you as a citizen of Oregon today. And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I really appreciate the opportunity to be here and talk a little bit about the importance of watershed councils.
Thanks for taking the time to show up. We appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. You're hearing today from a number of people with far more experience with watershed councils than I have. Still, during the past several years, I've had the privilege of both volunteering for and working with local watershed councils near my home in the southern Willamette Valley. I've seen firsthand the way that local citizens come together to work on projects that they've had a hand in identifying. I've watched people come together in watershed council meetings to discuss, for example, in a very respectful way, a challenging issue such as off-road vehicle use in natural areas. I've worked with an incredibly dedicated and diverse group of volunteer council members from the timber industry, conservation organizations, city and state agencies, university scientists, and others as they struggled with the challenge of coming to consensus on ecological objectives for an urban stream. And it's quite frankly, it's inspiring to work with people who are there in their own time, putting that kind of effort and creativity into what they're doing. And lately, I've had the opportunity to work to see this sort of work throughout the state. Council's working with local partners such as the Soil and Water Conservation Districts and with schools, small landowners, large timber owners, agricultural interests, tribes, conservation groups, counties, cities, state and federal agencies, and more. Taken together, it becomes clear that watershed councils are playing a critical role, not just in achieving ecological restoration work on the ground, and that is extremely important, but they're also helping to change the way that people understand and work with their watersheds. In essence, they are going to the heart, and Jeff mentioned this, the heart of what the Oregon Plan envisioned, creating a locally driven, citizen-based shift in natural resource management that's aimed at the recovery and restoration of watersheds throughout the state. And this is a shift that's not based on regulation from above, but rather one generated by the conversations, agreements, and initiatives of local communities. One of the keys to this success has been the state's investment in supporting watershed councils and their partners. According to a recent University of Oregon study, for each dollar that OWEB invests in watershed council support, the councils bring in, on average, an additional $3.72 in other state, federal, and private contributions. And this does not account for the additional OWEB project funding, which is about another $1.40 or so for each dollar in council support. And of that money, between 80 and 85% of it is spent within the county where the council is located. That is, the money goes on the ground where it's spent. Without sufficient support for council coordinators and the capacity to keep the doors open, this ability to leverage the state's investment cannot be maintained. Nor can the volunteer commitment be sustained, nor the restoration work accomplished on the ground. In order to continue to work effectively in partnership with other organizations, councils need sufficient funding so that they themselves can be strong and capable partners. In closing, I recognize and respect the difficult task that you all face in determining the most effective use of limited resources. Please do your best to provide sufficient non-capital and federal funds in the OWEB budget to allow that agency to provide the support necessary for councils to work effectively throughout the state so that they can continue to achieve what I think is really the triple bottom line of the Oregon Plan. That is healthier watersheds, stronger local communities, and vibrant local economies. Thank you very much for your time.
Very good. Thank you, John. Members, questions of John? Got off lucky.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, John. Appreciate you coming in today. Mike Burton, welcome. Good to see you again. And on deck is Jake Gibbs. Welcome, sir. State your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mike Burton. I'm here today in my capacity as a member of the Johnson Creek Watershed Advisory Council. And with me back here is Michelle Bessard, who is, as Jeff put it, one of those underpaid and overworked executive directors of the watershed. I first got involved with the Johnson Creek Watershed Council probably over 10 years ago when we helped put together one of the first community efforts to take a look at generating a conversation between businesses along Johnson Creek and the citizens who live there to see what we collectively could do to try to repair and maintain that important waterway. Johnson Creek, for those of you who don't know, runs all the way from urban Clackamas County down through the urbanized rural Clackamas County all the way through the urban portions of Portland, and has a population in that basin of about 170,000 people. I'm here today to ask you to hopefully increase the pool of federal and non-capital funds in the OWEB's budget in order to support an essential part of what the watershed councils do. I'll tell you how hardworking Michelle is. When we yesterday, and what a technical buffoon I am, I sent her my testimony about through a PDF format, and she got down this morning and said, I never got that. So I sent her out to find a computer about an hour ago, and she put together the testimony, and we'll make that available to you later on once we get it back out. So, what conservation practices that the Watershed Council are, I think, defined and termed by terms such as restoration, rehabilitation, enhancement, and all inclusively as improvements. Yeah, none of these resource management strategies is possible without one essential ingredient, and that's human resources. It's not just any human resource. It's the capital funds that are provided, not capital funds that are provided to provide support funding for monitoring, technical assistance, and educational work. And they support the individuals and their organizations that put the projects on the ground that make all the difference. These are watershed councils are volunteer organizations, and the funds that you provide are the glue that help pull those volunteer organizations together to accomplish what they manage to do. The value of watershed councils, organizations, and individuals that serve on the front line of watershed restoration priorities and projects cannot be undervalued. And they're based on locally assessed and determined needs. The assessments I know of from my previous experience as a legislator show that the sum of the whole is greater than any of the parts, and I think that's the sort of thing that we want to try to achieve here. Watershed councils and their partners are making tremendous gains implementing the Oregon Plan. Federal and non-capital funds in the OWEB budget represent a modest but critical investment in supporting these gains and individuals carrying out watershed restoration projects in their own communities, in our backyards, your backyards, and across the state. A 2004 University of Oregon study demonstrated that through each dollar invested by OWEB in a watershed council, an additional $3.75 is leveraged, and that's the average. For Johnson Creek Watershed Council, that's more like a 5-to-1 match, or approximately $5 leveraged for every $1 of OWEB's non-capital investment. We wouldn't wish that we all got that kind of return on our investments, but I can assure you that the 6,000 volunteer hours in the Johnson Creek watershed goes into the local economy for goods ranging from tools to food for work parties and to professional service contracting, in other words, jobs. Let me just give you an example. On one day this year, on March the 5th, which was not in our local area a really nice day to be out, we had a project out there of volunteers. The watershed event pulled 500 volunteers. They removed 2 tons of invasive species and materials along the area, and they planted 1,500 trees and shrubs in a restoration project. Annually, we have active repair and restoration projects in 10 of the 26 miles of the mainstream of Johnson Creek. And we have currently 3 fish passage projects underway for removal of barrier projects or barriers that exist in the waterway. One of those is on private property, one is on a public golf course area, and another one is in a combination of public and private property. So these projects do get on the ground, and the money that you provide to help do that is invested in that way. So I'd ask you to advocate for and approve the funds necessary to supplement the governor's budget request to fully fund watershed council support. At a minimum of $4.2 million, which is what was funded in the last biennium, at the top of the scale, we'd love to see you do $6.6 million, which would fully fund watershed councils. And those funds we hope would be available through a combination of funds that you might be able to be able to find, but I realize how difficult that is. Your support for enhanced budget will reflect the confidence and esteem you place in local place-based solutions that contribute to the overall quality of life for Oregonians. Your support will tell tens of thousands of volunteers that you value their work and the work that they're doing. Your support for enhanced budget will underscore the watershed councils and tell how much they value and how much good they do in restoration work. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you.
Mike, thank you. Questions?
I just wanted to say to Mr. Burton, you know, it's been alluded to already, but the beautiful thing about this is people, Johns Creek bisects my district and Senator Shields, but there's folks from inner urban areas and rural people clear out in the middle of, forgive me, nowhere, that all around the state are working on these things. And you know, that's the beauty of this. And we can't put it in a performance measure, unfortunately, but I think that's the beauty of this money. It's money well spent, and we can calculate the benefits, not just water quality, salmon habitat, and restoration. Just the social benefit is just incalculable. So I just wanted to share that with you before you left.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Schaffer, I appreciate that. I think you're correct. The performance measures probably ultimately are going to be somehow figured out through the independent scientific review panels and that sort of thing. They'll come down with some way to measure whether or not the TDMLs and the flora and fauna come back the way that we want it to. But the other part of the capital investment here is really in the creation of a community around these projects. And the people that we pull out for these projects and the education they get about how important those areas are and what they do collectively and what they do together on those projects creates a bond in the community that can't be, I think, undervalued. So you're absolutely right.
I may do a plug here. You know, I think of our political structure here in the world, actually, but in this country is like a pyramid. And you got all this talking heads up here yakking away. You know what? I was one of those 500 volunteers on March 5th, and Michelle, Ms. Bussard, is instrumental in organizing those folks. I saw people at several other places lined up to work, and without folks like Ms. Bussard out there quietly doing their work, I mean, the whole pyramid falls apart. So I just wanted to plug her and thank her and all the other folks that do that same work in their communities. Without them, nothing's going to happen, not just this department, but all the departments.
I very much appreciate that, too, because as I mentioned, these are the people who are the glue that hold all that together, because they're the ones who get those volunteers out, find the right place, gets a shovel to the right thing, gives people the right kind of projects to do, and you can't underestimate that value. So thank you very much.
Very good. Mike, before you go, how long has it been since you sat on this side?
I left, the last session was 1993. And I certainly don't envy the task you guys have. Somebody the other day said, gee, Burton, can you go down here and prove what's going on? And I said, you know, no. Anybody who says that doesn't know what they're talking about, because you're faced with different problems, different financial issues. And I think it's amazing that we all volunteer, as you mentioned, because this is essentially effectively a volunteer. I wrote a piece in the Oregonian on Sunday that I was asked by the Oregonian, I guess they asked a lot of former legislators to sort of comment on how you can improve the process. And so I sent my piece in. They said 500 words. And I said, well, that's all I get. I'll stick to three significant things. And then they called me up, so they're going to run it on Sunday. I said, how many did you get? And I said, just yours. And that's kind of disappointing, because and maybe it says something to what's going on. But we really do need to, I think, take some significant steps to make it easier for everybody who goes through this process to do the work that you're doing. And I very much appreciate having been over there, how hard it is, and wish you well to, I'm going to say, to the end of your session. Hopefully that's in this fiscal year, but if it is next fiscal year.
I have a feeling it will be. Do you miss it not being here? Sometimes?
Not for a minute, really.
That's why you were the only one. Everyone else feels even more strongly than you do. Mike, thanks a lot. I appreciate your comments. All right. Jake Gibbs, you're up. And on deck will be Nan Evans. Jake, welcome. Do you have testimony?
Testimony for my county commissioners. I just have one copy and then a newspaper article that I'd like to just put before.
Outstanding staff will make us copies of that. Appreciate it.
Sorry about that.
Welcome, and for the record, state your name.
My name is Jake Gibbs. I'm a forester with Lone Rock Timber from the middle of nowhere.
That's okay. He accused me of being from Sublimityville. Okay, so.
But no, I'm out of the Roseburg. Out of the Roseburg area, and I am also on the board of directors for the Umpqua Basin Watershed
Just
Council.
Just for the record, Mr. Chair, I grew up in a community in Iowa of 7,000 people. I live
so you know
nowhere is where it's at.
Very good.
Everybody to know.
And I'm going to be echoing very much what you've heard from the previous testimonies on the support that needs to be maintained for watershed councils. But I'd like to give you maybe from a timber company's perspective on why we're so supportive of the Oregon Plan and our local watershed council in particular.
Please.
We've been involved, Lone Rock Timber and myself particularly, have been involved with the local watershed council for over 10 years. I've been on our local watershed council for 5. Rick Sohn, the president of our company, was instrumental in founding the predecessor to the Umpqua Basin Watershed Council, and then served as very strong influence on the local watershed council. So we've been very actively engaged in this process for a long time. Why do we think this is so important? Well, it's real simple. We think local individuals are best suited to solve our local problems. I think that's something that's very appealing to us. And that with our watershed council encompassing the land base that it does, it covers 1.7 million acres that we're working in the Umpqua. We can expand this to a regional scale, and we've been working very hard to do that over the last 10 years. Lone Rock is a forest landowner with a significant amount of fish streams on our property. So, again, we have a vested interest in how we manage our forest lands, and then how they impact the streams that are valued by not only us, but the rest of our neighbors and the rest of Oregon. We are very attracted to the philosophy of not just identifying problems, but actually working towards solutions, which the Oregon Plan seems to actually motivate us to do. It doesn't just say there's a problem, but it says let's get some incentive to go out and improve things. And the sense of community. We are very active in our community, and we find that the Watershed Council, and I find this because I sit on the board, is a very unique opportunity to sit down with people that I would never sit in the same room with on a regular basis, and we work toward a common goal, which is to improve our watershed. As I said, the Umpqua Basin covers about 2,600 square miles or 1.7 million acres, so we have quite a piece of the landscape that we're working on. Some of our successes in the last 2 years, we've implemented 33 projects, which may not sound like much, but those varied in scale from watershed assessments to in-stream log and boulder placements, fish passage culverts replacements, stream temperature monitoring, flow monitoring, fencing, ditch removal, water quality monitoring, and we're working on public outreach. When you have the hinterland as your home base, it's kind of hard to figure out how to get the message out, but we are struggling with that challenge. And if you can also take those projects and realize that we're allowed to work in the stream from July 15 to September 15th, it kind of scrams things together, but we are very diligent in doing that. We're very fortunate we have a very active and engaged council and staff. We have over 15 board members. We meet monthly. We have very easily 30 to 40 people that attend these meetings on a regular basis. These are public citizens, folks like myself, agency, both federal and state. And then our very skeleton staff that keeps us all together and make sure we're moving forward. The projects that we've done have involved a variety of landowners, which is very important when you're wanting to know where your dollars are being spent. They are going on that landscape out there. It's a variety of private landowners, timberland companies, private small woodland owners, small and large ag producers. BLM ownership in our neck of the woods is that checkerboard, so they have been a very valuable partner in also allocating funds, but because of the nature of their ownership, they're very much like just another landowner on the landscape, and so they've been very helpful in working with, but it makes sense to do work on their projects when they're right next door. They allow access to private lands, which is very common with roads and right-of-ways. The Forest Service and DEQ are also engaged in our Watershed Council, either supplying technical support, because I don't have a fish biologist in my back pocket, and ODF&W is very helpful, but not always the only people are around. And DEQ with water quality. If we did not have a relationship with DEQ, then we wouldn't know if we were making progress or not on their water quality standards and issues. I think the Umpqua Basin Watershed Council demonstrates the effectiveness of the Oregon Plan very, very well. We're having a tour May 21st. If you got nothing better to do on a Saturday morning than to drive around Myrtle Creek and see what we've done, you're more than welcome to join us. But
for Chair Morgan, will be there.
I will speak for her, sure. We'll have him, sure.
Okay.
But we're not done with our work. Although, as much as I'd love to be able to sit here and tell you that we've got it all solved in the Umpqua and we don't need any more money, that isn't the case at this juncture. We need to increase involvement, understanding of our landowners in our basin, and we're working taking a small template, I guess, and working in Myrtle Creek specifically and trying to figure out a way to incorporate the rural and urban neighbors that we have, and if we can increase their involvement and engagement, then maybe we can expand that across our land base. We have implemented or are just about to implement some projects that will, I guess, from my standpoint, maximize our return on investment, identify that for us. We have implemented something we call UBFAT, Umpqua Basin Fish Access Team, which the simplest thing we've discovered, which this article shows, is culverts are a major problem in allowing access to fish habitat. So we're trying to identify which culverts we need to remove and how to prioritize those, which ones make the most sense to invest in. We have a strategic plan and a work plan as well. So if there is some logic to our madness. OWEB, while very critical in our funding mechanisms, is we're trying to expand beyond looking to OWEB to be the only funding source for these projects. There are private foundations out there. We are a 501c3. We need to capitalize on that and start finding other ways to fund the projects and the staff that we have. But at this juncture, we're still very dependent on the OWEB dollars and the OWEB staff to account for those dollars and to make sure that we're still moving forward. We have a tremendous amount of monitoring and assessment to be done. We've done a lot of work, and we have some kind of periphery idea that we're doing good things, but it'd be great if I could come to you and put down in black and white and say we have improved fish habitat X percent. All I have right now is what my gut tells me. I can tell you on forests that I've worked on and streams that we've worked on, the log structures that we put in 8 years ago, you can't see them because they've been buried. They did exactly what they're supposed to. They're buried by the sediment, streams meandering. There's pools formed. That's been brief, but that's my one, that's a quick story right there. We've done numerous projects of with agriculture, of a great one that took a long time, involved removing a dam for flood irrigation. It was a 23-foot high dam, and it involved 12 landowners. And you were asking if landowners were, readily to sign on the dotted line. This one took 2.5 years to convince that it would in turn be a beneficial problem. They had very strong resistance to accepting having agency people on their lands and having some concerns over how this was all going to turn out. Now they're on sprinkler irrigation, everyone's happy, but it did take quite a long time, and it was not an easy process. And if it hadn't been for our coordinator, we wouldn't have had those 6 miles of stream opened up. So that's some of the investment there. And that's where I guess I'd get to what Lone Rock supports from the governor's recommended budget, and then what I'd like to encourage you to add on to it, since I can make that suggestion. First, the funds for capital projects that have been recommended, we firmly support. If we could have every dollar, for every project that we put forward, if we could get it funded, that would be fabulous. We have a surplus of work to be done and limited capital dollars to get those projects done. And some idea in relation to how the number of dollars that are going on the ground and how much, I guess, maybe we're putting in kind. Typically, it's a 50-50 investment. Now, I don't know how the dollars are coming, how much is completely allocated to OWEB and then how much I totally get, but I know that on the culverts that we've installed, it's our labor, our machines, our people, and we're asking for the pipe on a project that we wouldn't have done in the time frame that we'd be operating there. The thing that needs the most, and as you've heard from the other testimony, the most attention is the funding for our Watershed Council staff. These are pretty bare-boned offices. Our coordinator, and we have a fiscal administrator, I guess is the title. It's an outfit that deals with over $1 million in a year. That is some serious responsibility when you're dealing with state funds, dealing with a variety of personalities like myself and, say, some of the counterparts on our council, which might be takes a certain caliber of individual to be able to handle dealing with us. And they need to be compensated. We've been very fortunate that these people, that our particular coordinator's been with us for 7 years and hasn't seen a pay increase in that time. Now, and that's going with his eyes open. This is not a job to be getting wealthy on, but he does a fabulous job. We need to maintain that integrity and that continuity. Otherwise, I won't be as successful as a Watershed Council. So I'd encourage, from the governor's recommended budget of 2.4 that he line-itemed for Watershed Council support, that should go back to what was a couple of biennia ago, 4.1 at a minimum, if not more. If those dollars can be negotiated or arranged, that would, without the Watershed Council, it's kind of going backwards. Without the coordinators and that brief staff, we don't have the people to bring us together. We don't have the non-capital support for technical assistance and planning and so forth. We can't design projects. Doesn't do me a whole lot of good to have a ton of capital project dollars if I don't have the other two components to actually get to utilizing those parts. So that's more than enough than I needed to share with you, but if you have any questions, I'd gladly answer them.
Very good. Yes, Representative Schaffler.
How are your efforts to get other sources of financing funding? How are you doing in that area?
It's been good. we've been able to actually move forward, but those pots of money are limited as well. We've utilized EPA $319 through DEQ, the BLM and their title $2. I can't keep the which titles, but the BLM's been very engaged, active in partnering those dollars up when we can work with that, the Forest Service dollars as well. But that's been the pots we've gone after, and we just haven't had the, as volunteers, we haven't figured, we don't have that. We have a new member that has some expertise in nonprofit fundraising, and so that's where we've got this new motivation to go and address that. But we've been successful enough to match the OWEB dollars. You know, as you've heard, it's been very, it can be done, and we've been very successful as our council workload.
Thanks, Jake.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it. All right, Nan, you're up. And on deck is Michael Mason. Michael stepped out the door there. Welcome, Nan. Good to see you. And state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair Croft, members of the committee. My name is Nan Evans. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Nature Conservancy in Oregon. There have been, you know, many heartfelt and eloquent statements made here today, and I don't think I can add to any of those. I could also go on about the Nature Conservancy and our role and our partnerships with the agency and other members, but unless you're specifically interested, I'll skip that part too and keep my comments fairly short. First, to thank all of you for your efforts to deal with the many difficult budget issues this session. We know that natural resources in total is maybe around 2% of the state budget, but it is certainly more important than that 2% might otherwise indicate. You may also know that one of the highest legislative priorities for the Nature Conservancy this session is a strategic conservation investment package using the revenues from Measure 66 lottery funds and the Pacific Coast Salmon Recovery Funds. As a footnote here, my comments will be directed only to that part of Measure 66 that comes into the natural resources piece, not the park piece. We, as a conservancy, firmly believe that we as Oregonians have created a wonderful opportunity for us as a state to invest in habitat and watersheds and to reinforce Oregon's long-standing commitment to the real work being done on the ground through community partnerships. And we greatly and deeply appreciate a lot of the conversations that you've had amongst yourselves. We found ourselves in the happy position of being able to fully support the governor's recommended budget with respect to OWEB and its proposed use of the Measure 66 and the federal salmon dollars. And I have a few suggestions and recommendations to you that are in basically two subject areas. The first area is an area that you all have certainly discussed during your hearings on the OWEB budget this session, and that is the need to increase the accountability about how the dollars are spent, about what difference it makes on the ground, and to assure the effective use of public funds. In that regard, I would add our support to the agency's request for funding to maintain the grant program manager position, for funding to develop the data management functions. This is the computer guy gal position that you talked about yesterday. We believe that investment will allow more informed evaluation of the program's accomplishments and indicate areas for improvement. And we would support funding that's currently in the agency's request to improve the agency's ability to report on the outcomes through an effective outreach and education program. I do have two additional suggestions that you consider. One would be that you direct OWEB to require that each grant recipient inform the legislature through working with their individual local legislators about the outcomes of the work they're doing. And I don't mean this to be an onerous reporting, paper-generating category at all. It could be making sure the grant recipients visit with the local legislators, invite them to help pull weeds, or take them out to a site to see what the work is being done. I think it will help improve the accountability of the program, just that simple little requirement. I would also encourage you to consider placing on the agenda of the interim Joint Legislative Audit Committee, if there is one, this upcoming interim, what I would call an effectiveness and outcome-based audit of how all of the major 66 funds are being spent by all of the agencies receiving these funds. I know that the language of Major 66 does require the Secretary of State to audit the program, and I believe there is an audit that they are almost to the public stage of being ready to release it. I, of course, have no idea what it says. But I'm suggesting that there's more to an audit than is the agency fiscally responsible and are they complying to the Constitution? It's, you know, how effective are these dollars actually being and doing work on the ground, and that you consider adding that to the agenda of a legislative audit committee. The other area where I have a couple of recommendations, I sort of put in the category of perhaps legislative leadership and efficiency, and that is I would encourage you as part of your work now in this committee to increase the expenditure limitation to accommodate the expected increased revenue that is resulting from the expansion of the lottery games. I understand the number that is floating around is that increase to the Major 66 natural resource piece is about $9 million. I would encourage you, as I said, as part of your work in this committee, to increase the expenditure limitation in the capital grants program at OEB by the 65% required by the Constitution, and that comes out to somewhere around $5.8 or $5.9 million. And then I would encourage you to use the non-capital or the operational piece, the remaining piece of the increased revenues, and use that to fully fund the operations of the Watershed Councils. I think it's already been mentioned here today. The current biennium funding for the Watershed Councils is about $4.1 million. That's a combination of Measure 66 funds and federal salmon funds. The agency request budget has, I believe the total is about $2.4 million for the 05-07 budget from Measure 66, and I think you've heard today that's simply not enough. I would encourage you to use that increased revenue on the non-capital operation side of the lottery from the expanded line games to fully fund those watershed councils and to reduce their dependence on the federal salmon dollars, which, as you know, the federal salmon dollars that we expect to receive this year will be less than we expected 6 months ago, and the future of those dollars is quite unclear. Those are my basic suggestions. I told you I'd try to keep this really short. Just by summarizing that the Conservancy strongly supports the use of Measure 66 and the federal salmon dollars as an investment in conservation. These are activities that protect fish and wildlife and the habitats they need to survive. And I would encourage you, it's not just about salmon. It is about the whole spectrum of the habitats and the organisms that live there, to repair Oregon's green infrastructure and to support our local communities and help create jobs in our rural communities. And with that, I'll close my comments. And, again, thank you for your efforts.
Thank you. I mean, when you audit something and the effectiveness of the use of the money, you have to know it's effective. And if it isn't in here, what would you suggest would be an effective use of the money?
I think the most effective use, and I think the councils, watershed councils, are doing a very good job on the ground. But I think, as was indicated earlier, that's not a known piece of information. I have an opinion because I'm sort of part of that community. But I think it would be important to look to see how it is being spent. Your comment about Maybe one of the most important things is that they involve every member of the spectrum of communities in it, and I think that's important things to look at. And it's not just numbers, and it's not just counting fish, and it's, you know, those are all indicators, but it's a very wide set of indicators I think we need to look at.
Well, thank you, Nan.
Sir?
Michael Mason.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, thank you for making time for hearing from us on this important budget. The Confederate, Michael Mason for the record, the Confederate Tribes of the Warm Springs considers Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board a very important partner in salmon restoration and in restoration of salmon habitat. We were very pleased in 1999 in House Bill 3225 when a tribal position was included on OWEB, and it is a tribal leader from Warm Springs who is currently on the board, Bobby Bruno, our Director of Natural Resources, very experienced in restoration of habitat, and as I understand, done a lot of good work to help connect OWEB with the other tribes around the state, as was intended by the inclusion of this seat in House Bill 3225. The Warm Springs seated areas include 9 counties. OWEB has funded hundreds of projects in those counties over the last half decade. Grant County is a critical area for us because we have the John Day River, the longest uncontrolled river in the state. Just there alone, OWEB has funded the removal of thousands of acres of juniper, water-sucking juniper, as we call it, and noxious weed removal, along with funding alternatives to gravel push-up dams, which are a particular problem in the summer months. In Hood River County, there are several projects funded that aid the work of ODFW and the tribes on their experimental fish-rearing facility next to the Hood River, where we take wild fish eggs and raise them in as natural an environment as we can. And we're studying the impacts of that for, you know, hatchery reform, really, and how effective those changes are to a more natural state to fish survival.
Well, how long have you been doing that project?
That project has started. We started working together on that in 1998, as I recall.
So, when do you expect to be able to look at that over enough of a trend to have any idea whether that's, you know, what you're trying to do?
Well, I'm trying to remember when the first fish were actually released from there. I think it wasn't until 2000, so we're just starting to be able to count. And, of course, the counts this year are pretty abysmal on the Columbia River. So we have a problem with figuring out why the fish counts are so low this time around. But it's going to be, with this very odd year that we're having, it's going to be another 2 or 3 years. I'll happily share that information probably at the next, if we have enough information, we'll happily share that with the legislature in the next session.
Do you know if any of the tribal members are going to be working with Department of Fish and Wildlife on that hatchery they've got down here on the coast now, the research hatchery?
The Warm Springs hasn't been involved with that. I don't know about the coast tribes. They'd be doing that. But I did want to say, you know, and I'm going on and on. In my mother's home, you know, cleanliness was next to godliness, but in the people's house, I think brevity is next to godliness, so I will cut myself off. Much work is also being done in Wasco County, especially on 15 Mile Creek to aid fish passage. It's a critical source of eels, which are treasured by elders of the tribes because they're very important medicine. They're a vital source of domestic tranquility for the elders, and we can talk about how there was a time when there was no need for Viagra in this great land thanks to eels. But the tribes urged the subcommittee to fund OWEB at the governor's recommended level, increase the expenditure limitation from the lottery expansion, and maintain the grant manager position and, you know, funding for other monitoring and personnel, especially these watershed coordinators who are critical to keeping these on-the-ground efforts going, and I'd be happy to answer any questions and get out of your
hair. Do you have any questions? Hey, we're letting you off easy, Michael.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Excellent.
Les Helgeson and Chris Winter, are they here in the back?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Les Helgeson. I'm here today representing Native Fish Society and the Native Plant Society of Oregon. We would like to express our concerns about the appropriations in House Bill 5074, particularly under Sections 1 through 4 and 6 through 8 of the bill. It appears to us that other agencies are receiving nearly twice as many funds as are provided for in the spending limitation for the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. And as you know, the Oregon voters passed Measure 66 in 1998 by a substantial margin. And subsequently, the Oregon Constitution has provided for that the money be administered by one state agency. House Bill 3225 was subsequently introduced during the 70th Legislative Assembly and passed in 1999. The bill implemented Measure 66 through Oregon statutes by establishing OWEB as the one state agency to administer funds allocated under Measure 66. So I think it's clear that OWEB is the principal funding mechanism for most grassroots watershed restoration efforts, yet a substantial portion of the available funds could be available, have been and continue to be diverted for the purpose of backfilling state agency budgets, thereby transforming what was intended to be a citizen-driven plan into an increasingly bureaucratic governmental process with relatively little accountability or oversight. Now, back in February, you heard from Deputy Director Ken Beerley that OWEB is generally able to fund less than two-thirds of the projects that are actually approved. I think they specifically stated they approve two-thirds of the applications they receive and then only can finance two-thirds of those projects. And I think you've heard a lot of wonderful things here today about what's going on out in the field. I've had some experience with that out on the Nestucca River in Tillamook County where I live. It is said there are more cows in Tillamook County than there are people, so which is part of the issue. But clearly, OWEB is unable to monitor and account for the effectiveness of the Oregon plan due to a shortage of the operating funds in particular. And I think you've heard some about the performance indicators and benchmarks and so forth. You've also heard from Vice Admiral Conrad Lautenbacher regarding the federal PCSRF funds and the concerns there with the agency backfilling, which in their view may be preventing or delaying progress in salmon restoration and recovery. And we were given assurances earlier in the year by the governor's office that the amount of backfilling being proposed would have been reduced this session. But as far as I can see in House Bill 5074, we are seeing just about the exact same dollar figures as were appropriated last session. I hope I'm not mistaken there. And we feel the backfilling is being made in order to avoid cuts to other programs that we feel at times are harmful and serious impediments to recovery efforts here in the state of Oregon. And the huge problem there is that Measure 66 funds under this House bill would continue to be diverted at the detriment of the groups working on the ground for rail improvement. And again, I think we've heard many indicators here today that these projects on the ground can be quite successful and do good things. So our primary objection to the continuation of the backfill practice is that the allocation of these funds to various state agencies violates Measure 66 and the Oregon Constitution, as well as the implementing statutes. In our view, it is unconscionable that the state of Oregon continues to take millions of dollars from local community and watershed groups to backfill agency budgets, while concurrently falling woefully behind on effective recovery and monitoring efforts. And I'll finish up here with a small example. I live, like I said, on the Nestucca River, which by most standards is a small feeder stream, if you will, particularly here in the valley or the Columbia. And currently we're addressing a range. There appear to be 50 to 80 culverts that are high priority out of 500 on this small coastal watershed that are impeding fish passage. And these culverts can range, you know, in cost from $50,000, $60,000 to hundreds of thousands of dollars, depending on location, size, and so forth. And I've been working with a local technical committee on behalf of Native Fish Society to address some of these concerns, and we've been making progress on recovery. But we don't have enough dollars to accomplish this. And this is one small watershed. There are numerous other councils on the coast who have come up short on dollars and good projects just because the money is not there. And this is a huge problem we're facing. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Chris Winter here, who is representing Native Fish Society in a legal capacity. Then we can answer any questions if you have.
We've got about 11, 12 minutes. How much should we have time?
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Chris Winter. I'm a public interest environmental attorney. I'm working with the Native Fish Society on the issue of Measure 66 funding. I'd like to thank the committee for their time today. It's a critical issue for the state of Oregon. We've heard some pretty convincing testimony today from folks on the ground that are actually using the money. So I've got the sort of unenviable task of discussing the legalities of the system. So I'll try to be brief, but I do want to make a couple of critical points. The people of Oregon passed Measure 66 and envisioned that the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board would be doling out the money from the lottery through the grants program to community groups, nonprofits, watershed boards, local governments, and other entities. The people also envisioned that the OWEB would be the primary state agency, and they required that one state agency administer the program. The voters' guide and the press at the time clarified that the money will be distributed through grants to nonprofit organizations, watershed councils, and other organizations. So based on the language of Measure 66, as well as the material available to the voters, it's clear that the people of Oregon understood that one agency, OWEB, would be making the decisions on where the money goes and would be administering that money. Now, we feel, Native Fish Society feels, that the backfilling of state agency budgets using Measure 66 funds runs afoul of the constitutional and statutory system set up by the people of Oregon and the legislature. More specifically, it possibly runs afoul of this one state agency language in Section 4B of Article 15 of the Oregon Constitution. Now, the Attorney General has recently released a draft opinion that addresses this issue, and we've provided the draft opinion to the committee for your review. The Attorney General, in the draft opinion, appears to sanction the backfilling of state agency budgets with Measure 66 funds. We don't know when we expect to see a final opinion from the Attorney General's office, so I do want to emphasize that it's a draft opinion at this point. But the Attorney General's opinion is basically based on an analysis that the administered by one state agency requirement means in this situation that OWEB, the one state agency, merely must ensure that the funds are used for the constitutional purposes, but the legislature can and has the permission under the Constitution to actually decide where those funds go. And we'd like to respectfully submit that the people who have established OWEB actually is the agency to determine where the money goes. So we would caution the committee to rely on the Attorney General's draft opinion. We believe the draft opinion misinterprets the plain language of the Constitution, particularly the administer language. Pursuant to the plain language, we believe that language means to direct or superintend the execution, use, and conduct of the Measure 66 funds. And to direct the use of those funds, in our view, is to determine what groups can use that money and for what projects. We also believe the opinion contains a questionable analysis of the constitutional language, and we hope the Attorney General will reconsider that interpretation in his final opinion. And we also believe that a close reading of the language clarifies the legislature's role in this situation is to describe to the agency and appropriate to the agency how much money will be given out in any individual year or session, but that it's the agency's role to determine who shall get that money and how it shall be spent. And that's an interpretation, really, of the appropriation language in the Constitution, Article 15, Section 4, Subsections 4D. So I don't want to belabor the legal issues. We appreciate your time today. We'd be happy to answer any questions, and we would urge the committee to fulfill the intent of the people of Oregon and fully fund the Watershed Enhancements, OWEB's grant-making program.
And one question for Les. Les, you made some comment that the money had been used for places that you thought were harmful programs. What were the harmful programs?
I'll try to be as brief as possible. I'll cite one on my home river. As I said, I live on the Nestucca River. The hatchery program there's a couple of them that have been imposed upon otherwise healthy stocks of fish. And based on the information available, we're seeing unprecedented decline in those wild populations relative to other watersheds. That isn't a precise scientific study, but we have, for example, with a winter steelhead fishery, their past 3 years of adult spawning surveys indicate a population of roughly 10,000 wild steelhead, which have recovered substantially in this watershed, which is about two-thirds BLM and Forest Service ownership. Based on conservative harvest estimates from ODFW, we could impose a 20% harvest on those fish, which equates to roughly 2,000 fish, which is more than what's currently being produced by the hatchery program. And we have attempted to advocate for that, yet a new type of program which changes the brood stock without changing the hatchery program. I'm happy to hear the Warm Springs are doing what they're doing. There's a similar program on the Salettes where the Grand Ronde had imposed a new type of hatchery in addition to the hatchery stock. But there seems to be a fad that we just change the stock and everything's going to be all right. And I think we know that's not right. We're seeing some impacts from there. Same thing's occurring to our Chinook population.
I think that the new research hatchery of property ran, and if the right questions were asked, that could provide some of the future science we need to decide whether or not the policy choices we made in hatcheries is proper or that we need to change those. Do you think that hatchery can help us with that?
I think it can. Whether it will is another question, but I think it can.
Are we done?
So.
Chris, I was out of the room. Did you have a chance to talk about your prepared testimony?
Okay, I was just asked to look at the written materials we submitted.
Okay.
Appreciate your time.
I will do so. Thank you very much. Thank you to both
of you.
Anyone else who'd like to testify? Bill Cluding, come forward. If you're not signed up, we'll be happy to make you. Okay.
Sorry, I'm late to sign up.
It's perfectly all right. Bill, welcome. And for the record, state your name, please.
For the record, my name is Bill Kluding, representing Western Council of Industrial Workers, Chair Krupp, and committee. Thank you for having this hearing. I represent over 4,000 workers in this state, and our workers depend on timber. And timber comes mainly from a lot of our good watersheds. And we urge the committee to maintain the $4.1 million for OEB. We've done a lot of good work in our watersheds, but we need to continue this effort. And one thing I'd like to have you look at is the Coquille watershed. They maintain a steady crew of 8 to 11 year-round people, family-wise jobs, insurance, family insurance. And this is what they do, full-time work is watershed. They pay taxes back into the state. With the help of OEB, I'd like to see these little groups all over the state, up and down our coast, wherever a watershed. I see the need out there, and I see the manpower to do it, but without proper funding from OEB, it cannot be accomplished. Thank you.
Bill, thank you. Questions, Bill? Members? All right. Thanks, Bill. Anyone else? Hearing none, thank you all very much. I appreciate your dedication and passion for OEB. Again, the Director Beiler, you've gotten great endorsements here today. You should be smiling from ear to ear. And with that, thank you all very much, and we are...